Tyler, I live with my wife and five children in Ghana, Africa. We've been there for about a year now, so it's been a good journey. But before I get into the presentation, there's a number of things that I've been processing the last months, and it comes down to freedom. Like we, as believers in Jesus Christ, we believe in freedom. But freedom comes with sacrifice, and sacrifice is paid by blood. Does my life and does your life show the reality that somebody died for us? It should light up a holy fire within you. Does it? Do I manifest that I care that someone died for me? Occasionally we read stories of firefighters, police officers, soldiers who die trying to save somebody else, and we're like, well, that's actually commendable. I can honor that. Did you ever stop and think, somebody died for you? Now we can say, oh, well, he died for everybody. Are you part of everybody or are you separate from the body? If you're born again, he died for you. And we simply say, yes, Lord, I receive. I was born here in Lancaster County. I was Old Order Amish. I grew up about an hour and a half northwest of here in a fairly dysfunctional Amish family. At the age of 14, I was kicked in the head by a horse, and I had a brain bleed and skull fracture. When I got to the hospital, I had less than 60 seconds to live. I was dying as I was rolling in through the doors. They ripped me back from the point of death. I had emergency brain surgery, and the doctors told me that I have permanent brain damage. I will never be the same again. 2 days later, I was still in the ICU. I was still unconscious. The doctors thought I had a good chance of making it, but I wasn't out of the woods yet. There's two guys knocked on the door, and they asked if they can pray for the patient in this room. At that point, I was considered too critical to have visitors outside of immediate family members, but the doctor left him in, left those two men in. They prayed for me and left, and I woke up that evening, walked out of the hospital 2 days later. My dad met one of those two men about 6 years later, and they said they were driving past Hershey Hospital on 322. God told them to turn around, go to the seventh floor in a specific room, and pray for a little Amish boy who's dying. Anyway, that was an interesting point in my journey, but I came out of there emotionally and mentally messed up. The doctor said that it damaged the part of my brain that controls my mood. And they said, this is the way you will now live your life. Within a few months, I lost my ability to read and write due to the effects of the injury. And I started having packs of demons come up to me at night. Now, you have to realize, we were Amish. We had never heard of this stuff. We had no frame of reference for it. But I was 14 years old, and these demons would try to come up at night and take over my body, and I would resist until I couldn't. I'd crash to the floor and cry and scream half the night for weeks. I became very suicidal. I became very demonically oppressed and suppressed. Ended up in the hospital. They released me. And then I got plugged into psychologists, psychiatrists, medications, and secular counselors where we simply numbed the demons. It was absolutely horrible dark. But the doctors had said, this is now how you're going to have to live your life because you have brain damage. We didn't have a way out. My brain injury was so severe, the doctor said it's going to take 3 years for the parts to heal that have a chance of healing. So over the next few years, things improved slightly, but I was heavily medicated. I was under psychiatric care, although I was living at home. And then I limped along like that, 16, 18, 20. I had multiple episodes of mental breakdowns or near mental breakdowns, and I became the mental basket case in the Amish community I grew up in. It was horrible, with capital letters. When I was 20, I was sliding into a mental breakdown again, and I was shipped off to counseling to a place in Ohio called Freedom Hills. I had two two-hour sessions. At that point, we were done bebopping around looking for help, and my parents were looking at putting me into a long-term in-house program where I would be medicated and put under intensive counseling for months and then see how that works. But since I was making a lot of money at work, we decided before I take off of work for half a year or however long it is, we'll go through Freedom Hills, do 2 days of counseling and see what happens. It changed my life because he sent me, led me to the Lord. And that's when I started pulling myself, I started being pulled out of the muck and the mire and the demonic that I had lived in for the previous 6 years. I was a brick short of a full load and I knew it. Mentally, I was probably 3 years less mature than my age, and I knew it, but I could not change it. That's a horrible feeling. I was a brick short of a full load. Before I became born again, I hung out in the corners, barely talked with people, and was fairly immature for my age. And people would guess about the age of 17 when I was 20. A year later, I was a youth group leader, and people guessed at 24 years old. That is the power and the transformation of Jesus Christ in somebody's life. I'm sharing this because it's part of my journey. A few years later, we stepped away from the Amish system, we married, and we went from Amish straight into Northern Iraq in 2014 to deal with the ISIS crisis. We were told before we leave we're probably going to die, or so we believed, and we were there for 6 months and we made it, but we experienced healings, we experienced spiritual warfare and very physical realities. We were close enough to the fighting, we could hear the fight with ISIS from our house some nights. But it changed our lives. We came back to the U.S., went to Bolivia for about 5 months, came back to the U.S. again, and then we started working for Light of Hope Ministries, the Lapp brothers, and we helped them start a ministry in West Virginia where we were one of the leadership team that helped start that. We were there for 2 years, went back to Iraq in 2018, 19, and 20 with Plain Compassion Crisis Response. By that time, we had two little children, and I found myself operating in the gray zone where it's not exactly the safe place to work, but I started looking at the war zones around the world back in 2018, and I realized wherever there's war, there's a lack of Christians, because when war happens, the Christians run out, who should have the authority, the military runs in, and the authority gets replaced, the Christians' authority with Bibles and loves and peace gets exchanged for the military authority of bombs and bullets. Now, we've got a problem here. And I found myself in Northern Iraq, close within an hour from some of the most dangerous parts of the country. Now, we were living in a fairly safe area at that point, but my work took me into some of these places. I found myself taking my wife and two little children into areas of the city of Mosul in Northern Iraq, right after daylight, where daybreak is when it switches from ISIS control to Iraqi army control. Now, I was like, what possesses me to do this? Why do I have my wife and children here? Like, am I a responsible husband and father, or what? Why? After I was there, I started asking myself these questions. And then I started seeing something. The darker the place, the more dangerous the place, when I took my family, the bigger the shift. Because the more open the people were, the more desperate they were, because they were closer to death. We're talking Muslims. I decided, as for me and my household, we're going to run into the fire instead of running away from it. For the next year and a half, 2 years, we worked in the front lines of Iraq. I went into Syria numerous times. I was almost executed at least once or twice that I know of. But we believe that if God sends us, it is his job to protect us. I would meet these old soldiers in Northern Iraq who were fighting for 50 years. They were fighting, and at war since they were 12, 15 years old. They now have white hair. They're still out in the trenches in their flip-flops in the mud. My question was, what possesses these men to do this stuff? And I was told they are willing to sacrifice their very life for their homeland. And it moved me to tears, and here's why. I was like, do I, as a believer in Jesus Christ, have that conviction within me? Does the body of Christ have that conviction? And I realized we have a few problems here. We have Muslims who are willing to die for a lost cause, but Christians who are barely willing to die for a just cause. This is out of order. When I was wrestling with this stuff, in the middle of this, I was in and out of military bases because we were working in conflict areas. In order to work there and access there, we needed to develop relationships with the military generals and commanders who had control of the area. So I had to have a lot of meetings, and drink a lot of tea with them simply to work among them with the civilians and the refugees. We ended up working on both sides of the front lines who were currently at a ceasefire at that point. We had free access to both sides of opposing militaries. Weird dynamic. But we actually befriended both sides. And we drive right through them as we're accessing the other side. My wife and two little children with me. But we rolled into West Mosul one morning, right after daybreak, after ISIS went underground, the Iraqi army moved in. We walked through a crowd of very dark men, knowing that many of them were ISIS and probably still ISIS. We walked through the crowd, and there was an Iraqi army soldier that was having a fist fight with one of the men. We walked past him. Right after we walked past him, we heard a shot ring out. And we kept on walking, and I realized later I didn't pay much more attention to that gunshot than I would have a barking dog. Because at that point, we had laid down our lives to God, believing he has us here for a reason, so therefore, it is his business to take care of us. We've lived overseas about 5 years now, in about four different countries. And in missions, we hear this thing, that we need to be willing to die for Jesus. We need to be willing to be martyred and persecuted and forever dead for Jesus. And I realized I'm not interested in that. I want to die to self now and be resurrected into the power of the kingdom of Jesus Christ. Tap into the power of the resurrection power of Jesus. I think it's in, see if I can pull it up here. John chapter 3, verses 1 to 8. Jesus was speaking with Nicodemus at night. And I don't have... Actually, I'm going to pull it up. Verse 2 is, Nicodemus was asking Jesus, and he said, "Rabbi, we know that thou art a teacher come from God, for no man can do these miracles except thou doest, except God be with him." Jesus answered and said unto him, "Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except that man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." It is through becoming born again and our lives becoming right with him that we can see the kingdom of God. Nicodemus saith unto him, "How can a man be born when he is old? Can he enter the second time into his mother's womb and be born?" Now listen closely, because verse 5 is where the juice and the power comes in. Jesus answered, "Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God," which is to step into it and walk in it, occupy and live there. Saturated and immersed in the holy power of God. That is what we need to break the strongholds and break the yoke of bondage. The darker the area, the more Jesus needs to show up. Why? Because we got the power. Or at least we should. I'm not ready to forever dead for Jesus. I would rather die to self. And the more of self in me that dies and leaves, the more of him comes through me. I'm not ready to die. But at the same time, if God chooses to take me, I am in. But not on the devil's term, God's terms. So therefore, it allows us to walk up to the gates of death and say, "Back off, I am here with the power of God." And that is the mindset that we walk through our time in Iraq and then Syria. If soldiers can go through boot camp and through the training, they can charge a machine gun nest without hesitation or flinching, then so should we. But here's the difference. They are limited with their military equipment, technology, and training, and we have all of heaven at our disposal. Later in our time in Ukraine, which I'll get that later, we had up to 10, 15 bombs get shot at us at once, over and over, and it never hit us. Because God sent us and he sent his angels with us. So it was, Iraq for those 2 years was an intense experience of believing that somehow God must show himself through people in these places, which means somebody needs to show up. Well, how does that work? The military controls these places. Are you lining yourself with the military? No, I am not. Here's my belief system. It is a body of Christ that is called to step up and do something about the chaos in this land and around the world. Prayer and spiritual warfare and intercession and worship is how we break through the strongholds and the bondages. We started walking this thing out, and I got the revelation one day that if we want the killing and the dying and the butchering to stop in this world, the church needs to rise up. Until the church rises up, the military will step in and fill the vacuum and kill people. I believe this. Now, I'm not saying everybody is called to do what we do. But you are called to step up in your sphere and your realm of influence with the pure love, the peace, the joy, and the transformation and power of God and bring heaven here. That's our assignment. We started going into Syria in 2019 and then into 2020. Now, by that time, I had experimented with this thing enough, and I wanted to go where nobody else goes because it's too dangerous. Why did I want to go there? Because I believed we had the solution to those places. And I ended up going into Syria, into these places that is too dangerous for people to go outside of the locals. Went in, came out. Went in, came out. Multiple times. Here's what I noticed. Once I crossed the border into Syria, the fighting stopped. Now, I would work right behind the front lines for 2 or 3 days, cross the border back into Iraq again, the fighting would stir up just like that. And it grabbed my attention. I was like, okay, there's obviously a spiritual dynamic happening here, but what is it? How do we break through this scene that the fighting stops? My third time into Syria, I ended up going 11 hours into central Syria, where I was closer to Jerusalem at that point than the Iraqi border where I had crossed over into Syria. We were among U.S. troops, Iranian troops, there was Russian troops, Turkish troops, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Syrian Kurds, or the 8 different military groups, all scrapping over a ginormous puddle of oil. If you don't believe that, you don't have to believe that, but let me tell you. There is, most of the wars in this world today are scraps. They're scrapping over natural resources and oil. In almost every single war zone, every war zone, I worked in 3 countries at war, and every single one of them was a fight over oil or natural resources. Now, that's not necessarily known, and I could probably stand here and speak for 2 hours of the conspiracy theory stories that happen in these places. That's not conspiracy theory, but it's reality. Stuff that I have no need to repeat here. But know this, it's not what you're taught and you're what you're told. Anyway, we ended up in the city of Raqqa, which was the ISIS capital when they held large parts of Syria. By that time, ISIS was mostly kicked out. It was controlled by the Syrian Kurds. And it was the city where al-Baghdadi, the ISIS leader, declared the kingdom of ISIS, the ISIS caliphate, for the first time in 2014. One evening, me and the 2 people that were with me went to that spot where the ISIS caliphate was declared publicly for the first time. We anointed the ground with oil, and we said, in the name of Jesus Christ, we cancel the ISIS caliphate. We declare from here on out that this country, this land belongs to Jesus Christ. And the fighting stopped. This was the spring of 2020. It did not fire back up again. I mean, there was small skirmishes here and there, but it did not fire back up again until November of 2024. I believe we have more power, more angels, more spiritual authority at our disposal than we realize. When I was working in Syria, I was sleeping in motels and eating in restaurants in cities where ISIS is blowing up motels and restaurants. To this day yet, when I sit in a restaurant, I try to sit where I can see the whole room and the doors. It's just a weird thing that came out of northern Iraq in our time in Syria, where they were blowing up restaurants and motels. The motel that I stayed in Syria was just around the corner from the bad guys. I could step out in the motel room balcony three or four floors up, and I could see the other side patrolling the street. I was told just don't walk that direction, so I didn't. I just watched them. But I slept in peace knowing that Jesus Christ sent us, and if he sent us, it is his job to protect us. We left Iraq when the Ukraine war started. I ended up in that conflict within a matter of days. Within 3 weeks into it, we were doing civilian evacuations out of Kyiv right in front of the advancing Russian forces. We had a team of about 21 people from five countries within 3 weeks after I got there. And I was the team leader. We put it together. When the Russians withdrew from Kyiv, we moved southeast to the city of Dnipro. We set up a base there. And we soon started working with a military chaplain where we started doing distributions and evacuations and church services in the gray zone between the two sides as they're fighting. And for the next year, that's where a lot of our work was. First 3 or 4 months, we worked there about 2 days a week. We're working with churches and humanitarian shelters the rest of the time. From October until June 1st, October of 2022 to about June 1st of 2023, I spent about 5 or 6 days a week on the front lines where the fighting was. I ended up spending about 3 months embedded in the Ukrainian military. I was running an ambulance. I've been an EMT for 6 years. So I ended up running an ambulance that was embedded with the Ukrainian mechanized brigade that was fighting in the city of Bakhmut, which had the worst fighting the world has seen since World War II. In a 20-mile section of fighting right beside where I was stationed with my ambulance, they had about 100,000 dead and injured soldiers every 30 days combined in a 20-mile stretch of fighting. It was a slaughter. There's probably close to a million and a half dead people in Ukraine in the last 3.5 years. It's time this thing stops. But we would go into these places. We would do distributions with the civilians and do church services. Russians are here, the Ukrainians are here, and we're beside machine gunners that are firing away, we're right beside mortar tubes, there's rockets flying overhead, there's tanks, artillery, howitzers. It's an absolute chaotic mess. We're driving past bodies laying on the roads, hanging out of vehicles, laying beside houses, and we're finding a group of civilians, and we're preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. Why? Because they're at risk of dying. Many times we went into these front line villages, did distributions, did a church service, and the next time we came back in, many of the people were dead. The question was, how long could we afford to keep taking the risk? But the question we stopped at was, can we afford not to take this risk? We were leading people to the Lord in these places. Many times people were running out of food or were completely out of food, and we would brave the rocket fire and show up. People would weep. We'd preach the gospel, pray for people that get born again, and we roll back out. There's times the Russians saw us and tried to blow us up. They always missed, and there's times they didn't. In many of these places, on our way in and our way out, we were driving roads that were fully exposed to the Russian military, some by drones and some by physical line of sight. And over and over and over, they tried to blow us up. I've been in places, been driving down the road when they dumped 10 or 15 rockets on us, and it looked like the movies. Fire and smoke and explosions and smells of cordite and gunpowder. It's war. It's horrible. However, it's a dark place, which means there is great opportunity. We decided that we're going to follow the steps of God. There was several times where we went into places where the soldiers said, if you go in there, you will die and you will not come back out. We went anyway. We came back out, and the military was like, it's not possible. Are you in contact with the Russians? It's the only way you don't die in there. We did a distribution to a hospital in a town in southern Ukraine that from the second we entered town, all the fighting stopped. I heard one distant explosion. Right before we entered town, I was watching Russian fighter jets circle the town. It was a din of explosions and war and fighting. We got in there, and the people said, you must be from God, because this is the first time the fighting stopped in 8 months since this war started, when you showed up and touched this place. Unbelievers told us this in that town. We left town again, the fighting started. What is that? Now, I had my wife and children an hour or two back from the fighting. That was where our main team base was. But the city was still getting bombed weekly, sometimes daily. And we got accustomed to being wakened that night, the house shaking, explosions rocking the area. We fall back asleep again. Why? Because it's merely a bomb. It'd kill people. Next day, everybody would go about, and everybody would assume that it'll hit somebody else, and most of them were right, and a few were not. We chose to put our lives into the hands of God. I spent a few days out on the front lines where it was complete chaos and war, came back, and I was at home for 2 days with my family. I was going to go back out again. Our oldest son, who was 6 years old at that point, was very clingy. He was not himself, and the night before I was going to leave, the next morning I was putting the children to bed, and I was like, Jariah, what is wrong? And he started crying, and he said, I'm scared you won't come home again. Now, this was in a time where I was being directly targeted weekly, sometimes several times a week, several times a day, where there was rockets and all kinds of stuff being shot at me and always missed. We had some very close calls. And he knew that. We didn't shield our children of what's happening around them. We brought them along on the journey. And he started crying. That was tough for me as a dad. I held him. He cried for a while. And then I explained to him that we are here on God's assignment. If we're all here on his assignment, then it's God's job to protect us. And therein lies our trust. He had wanted to do a whole list of things with me before I leave again. And I recognized at that point, he had a bucket list that he wanted to do with me before I die. That's what was going on in the six-year-old mind. It's tough. By the time we were done talking, something had switched in him. And he said, from that point on, he would tell other people that the Russians cannot kill Daddy because the angels would push the bombs away from him. And the fear left him at that point. Never came back that I'm aware of. One of the toughest things that we witnessed when we were extracting civilians from the frontline areas where the fighting was, we would roll into cities. There's bombs landing half a mile from us. The Russians had this one city surrounded on two or three sides, and we were not allowed the men weren't allowed to leave, but the women and children were fleeing. The reason the men weren't allowed to leave is so they're forced to stay and fight if they want to or not. So we would roll in and load up women and children and take them to the Polish border, and they would then end up getting dispersed throughout Europe. Many of them never saw their husbands and fathers again because they were killed. But what we witnessed over and over and over is we witnessed these families say their last goodbyes. These men would hold their little children weeping. And they'd load up in our vehicles and the women would fall apart. We had a few girls with us and they would just hold these women for a long time. That's tough. Many of those families never saw each other again. It's the sad reality of war. I ended up working with the military on a medical capacity. And it's horrible. But we did it with the mindset that we are not picking sides here. We are reaching the hearts of people with the gospel. We would roll into a frontline stabilization point. The Russians are bombing that very place. Roll in, hide the ambulance, and get into the building as fast as possible so we don't get hit or blown up by flying shrapnel on the way in. The Russians knew where the ambulance loaded up the patients. Every time that we had a bunch of patients in, I would back the ambulance up to the door and we would shove them in as fast as possible and get out of there before they drop a rocket on us. Did that for a number of weeks. It was intense. But we did it because we believe that it is the power of Jesus Christ that breaks the yoke of bondage, including the spirit of trauma and death. Many of the soldiers in that area, the kill rate was so high at that point. I started asking these injured guys that we were transporting how long they were fighting on that section of the front before they were injured and how many of their unit was left. Many of them were there 48 hours by the time they were injured. By that time, these were 100-man companies. Typically, they had 75% of the men dead in the first 48 hours. Talk about a meat grinder. It's horrible. We got to minister to some of these men. These guys were shot full of holes with shrapnel and bullets and concussed. Some of them were in very bad shape. But we got to minister to them. We got to transport them and go back into the fire and get more. But we did it because of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So we were in Ukraine for 15 months, and then the humanitarian side of things, it got, there was too many humanitarian organizations pushing humanitarian aid, where the frontline communities we were working in were begging organizations to not bring in humanitarian aid because it's destroying their economy. At that point, we greatly scaled down the work, and we actually put it on pause for probably half a year or a year, and we left the country. I went from working the front lines, embedded in the military, to Lancaster County, almost overnight. Talk about a shift. It went from rockets and explosions and the injured, the dying, the dead, and the screams, and tanks and war, to Lancaster County. This was two and a half years ago. We moved back from Ukraine. But we realized that it's as simple as being obedient where God has us. What I'm sharing is parts of our journey. You have your story. Business is one of the most underutilized forms of ministry. People call us missionaries because we live across the water somewhere, right? They're missionaries. What if we would realize that we're merely fulfilling the great commission that every single one of us was called to fulfill since we became born again? This is a lifestyle. If God has you in business or in the workforce, then that is your mission field. It's that simple. Radiate the gospel, the glory of Jesus Christ. Well, how do I do that? You impact people, shake their hand, look them in the eyes, smile at them. Speak life into people. The world is starved for something real. If you have Jesus Christ in you, you have the goods. If you're born again, you have the full package of Jesus Christ within you, and you have the DNA and the blueprint of the kingdom of heaven in your soul, in your heart, and in your life. Why isn't it fully manifesting through us as well as it should? I wrestled with this thing for a long time because Jesus Christ said that he will leave his Holy Spirit here, and he's going to leave, and he did that. But why ain't I operating at the level Jesus Christ was when he was here? I think one of the main reasons is I'm not mature enough. However, I am maturing. The more mature I get, the more God works through me. It is the simple facts of life. The more I give God the honor and the glory, allow him to work through me, the more he does through me, and he will through you too. We've got to let go of self. We've got to yield, surrender, and commit our lives and everything therein to the lordship of Jesus Christ. Family, finances, business, church, everything needs to be immersed in this thing. We need to be possessed with the love of Jesus Christ so it can flow through us into other people. It is the mandate on our lives if we tapped in to the power of the cross and then the resurrection. It's actually not that difficult. I've come to realize that God is more impressed with my simple faith and my simple walk with him than he is in the things that I do through him. I went through seasons where I had to wrestle with some things, and God was like, I'm actually more impressed with you than I am with what you do. Through that process, I realized what I do is many small things in life. If you do a million tiny things for Jesus, it actually looks pretty big. Focus on God, and whatever he decides to do through you is his business. For a number of months, I pressed in for the baptism of the Holy Spirit and the gifts of the Spirit, and I wanted this thing. I spent too much time pursuing the gifts instead of pursuing the giver of the gifts. Once I started pursuing the giver of the gifts, I got what I was after, which was intimacy with the Father. It's that simple. Be immersed in this thing and allow him to work through you. He made a donkey speak. He can do something through you as well. If he can light up the back end of a lightning bug, he can also light up
your mouth
and your life. And he will if you give him access. Anyway, I better get into what we're going here. So Crusades for Christ. We came back from Ghana. Robert Riggs-Secker, which I'm assuming some of you or many of you know, reached out to me, which I had known Robert for years already. And he was like, hey, Daniel, I'm going to Ghana for a short trip. You want to go with me? Now, we've been around missions and lived overseas already for a number of years. And told my wife, I see the handwriting on the wall. I know what he's after. He's trying to reel us in. I told my wife it's not going to work because we're not going to Ghana. But sure, I'll humor Robert and I'll go with him. So 2 years ago, we went to Ghana. I went to Ghana with Robert. We did a bunch of crusades, a bunch of ministry stuff there. First few days, I was like, why am I here? What is possessing me to be in Ghana? Like, I don't even understand why I'm here, and I was wishing I'd be at home. A few days later, Robert said something that changed it for me, and he started talking about the thousands of unreached villages in the country of Ghana. I said, what did you say? I'm very evangelistic. I think outreach and impacting people out there, in the streets, in the gutters, in the trenches, in the front lines. Anyway, by the end of the trip, we were talking of my family moving to Ghana because we were actually looking for something to plug into at that point. We had been living in West Virginia. I became an EMT again. I was started working on an ambulance. And we were just looking for something to do. So the timing wasn't quite right. A year later, which was December of last year, we moved to Ghana under Crusades for Christ International. Crusades for Christ was started about 28 years ago by Robert Riggs-Secker and Griner Church. Ray Weaver, which I'm not sure if you're here. I've never met you before. He was the director there for about 4 or 5 years. Was a very pivotal part of setting this thing up. And Crusades for Christ has started probably 20 to 25 churches in the last 28 years. Some of them ain't standing anymore. Many of them still are. But in 2022, the leadership transitioned from U.S. leadership to Ghanaian leadership. The last American director left Ghana, and it was placed into the hands of the local leaders, and they were under oversight of the board in Indiana. And I had already seen during our international work that the most high-impact missions that I saw were ones where the foreigners empower the local church, not necessarily lead everything. So for months before I went to Ghana, I had been praying that I could find a mission where I could go and serve under local leadership, not be the leader leading them. And that's how Crusades for Christ was set up. This was 2024. So we ended up in Ghana, and okay, where's my clicker thing? Let me turn it on. I don't like technology. I don't like running it, but I like when it works. There we go. This is Pastor Isaac. Isaac is the current director of Crusades for Christ in Ghana. We work very closely together. I work directly under him, but we work closely as a team with him and his cousin David. He got born again at the age of 14 or 15 out of a Muslim home. And him and his cousin David would go out at night and pray because that's what good Christians do. They were young in their faith. And they started interfering with the prayers of the local voodoo priest, and they got chased out because the voodoo priest could not talk to his demons if Isaac and David were out on the hillside praying. These were teenagers, new in their faith, zealous in the Lord, trying to do what's right. It's a dark place. There's people connected to the dark side that shoot fire out of their mouth, can spit up frogs. Isaac and David have seen witches riding brooms through the air at night, dressed in black. They discovered if they chase them, the witches lose their power and are forced to go back home again. Talk about intensity. So Isaac comes from a Muslim background, a fairly rough background. He ended up on the streets of Accra in 2005 or 6. Ray Weaver met him on the streets and pulled him out of the gutter. Changed his life, and he's now the director of the mission. It took about 15 years for that transition to happen. But from what Isaac said, it was Ray reaching out his hand to him that that sent him on his journey. He's a wonderful man. He preaches the fire of God. He is the apostle of the ministry. And he is passionate about reaching his nation and about planting churches. Great guy to work with. Oops, wrong direction, Daniel. So Pastor Isaac is David's cousin. When we ended up in Ghana, we were living in the southern part of the country at that point, and I was assigned to work closely with David with the street outreach that he was doing for the past 7 years now. He speaks the Mamprasi language. He grew up in a Mamprasi village, although he's not from that tribe. The Mamprasi people are a tribe of about 400,000 people in northern Ghana. They had come from one of the darkest places in the country. We now live there, and it is very dark. But anyway, the women and the girls from this tribe go to work the streets of Accra in the markets. They work the markets, and they carry these big bowls on their head with, when people buy a bunch of stuff at the market, they carry it to the bus stop or their vehicle with these big bowls, and they get paid to do that. So there's thousands of the Mamprasi women and girls from the north that travel 16 hours south to the city of Accra for weeks, I mean for months or even years at a time, and they work, make decent amount of money, send the money home to their families. When they work the streets of Accra, they actually live on the streets, live on the sidewalks, in the stands. It's, some of it's pretty rough, rudimentary conditions, but they've been doing it for years and they've figured out how to make it work. So David's full-time ministry is with these women and girls on the streets. Years ago, through another pastor, Pastor Kwame, we started a ministry center where we now have two church services on Sundays where these women and girls who are currently living on the streets, homeless, or that they do have homes in the north, come in for church and fellowship and community. For 7 years, David has poured his life into his women and girls. There's two evening services during the week where many of these girls come in, two services on Sundays, then Sunday afternoons, one or two teams split up and they go worship and pray and minister and preach on the streets to different groups of these Mamprasi women and girls that are living and working there. So I did that for 4 months. The first 4 months we were in Ghana. Isaac and David started talking about their home villages. They had a vision to go back to the villages where these people come from to see what the impact was of the street work in Accra. Over the past 15 years, there's been thousands of conversions and hundreds of baptisms from this tribe that's considered to be unreached people. The problem is they go home, get married to Muslim men, and they kind of leave their faith. Many of them do anyway. So the question was, how impactful is this work? So in January, Isaac, David, and myself drove about 14 hours north, and we went to 7 villages to see what's happening. Now, David knew numerous people in these villages because some of them he had discipled for a year or two when they were still working in Accra. So he had arranged stuff beforehand, and we got there, and we were totally shocked. After 7 years of full-time ministry in the city and 15 years of part-time ministry in the city, we discovered there is a harvest waiting to happen with the seeds having been planted 16 hours south in the streets of Accra. We went to village after village after village. Women and girls came running out of their houses, running up to David. He knows hundreds of people in these villages. We went into a village, and we were told that there was a girl who got born again and baptized on the streets of Accra through Crusades for Christ. She went home, started a church service under a tree that's still going to this day. After 7 years of not knowing there's any impact, David was in tears. He had no idea. He poured in and poured in, not knowing there was any impact, like lasting impact. We went into another village. We met this woman who was listening to an audio Bible she had gotten 3 or 4 years prior. And she said, "This Bible has changed my dad's life, who's a Muslim." Story after story. Soon the husbands and the fathers of these women and girls and the chiefs of the villages started walking up to us and thanking us for protecting and being there for their girls when they're on the streets of Accra. And we had no idea. We started getting request after request after request to start churches in these villages. Because of the work that was started in Accra for the last 10, 15 years, we were blown away and we had no idea. We went to a Muslim village where a bunch of the girls had gone through the ministry in Accra, and the chief told us, he said, I want you guys to start a church here. He's a Muslim man, steeped in witchcraft and voodoo and deep, dark debauchery. He said, where there is church, there is development. I want my village to succeed, so I want a church here. What do these guys understand that we don't? You have to realize, these are mud house villages that cook outside over open fires. It's very primitive. They do have motorcycles, they do farm some with tractors, have cell phones, electricity. But they live in mud houses, cook over outside cooking fires. In that trip, we got asked to start churches in 3 or 4 villages. Everywhere we went, hundreds of people knew us. Could you please start a church here? Next village, could you please start a church here? Because they wanted the presence in their village that they experienced on the streets of Accra. So we went back to Accra, and we decided that my family is going to move north with one of the church leaders from the street ministry in Accra who was living and working on the streets. David had baptized her, had discipled her, and she was on the worship team, and she was one of his trusted leaders. She said, if you're going to go north to my village, to our villages, I'm going to go north with you and help you. In April, I moved my family along with that lady. We moved north. She settled in her village again, and we simply started having a church in the dirt and the sheep manure under a tree. And to this day, we're still meeting at that spot. The lady in the center, her name is Barkisu. She was our point person, my point person. We had multiple meetings with the chief of the one village. There was no church there because the strong Islamists in the village ran all the other churches out of town or got things shut down. Have a new chief and he wants a church, so we're now there having church under a tree. It's a bit of an intense experience. But it is this lady here who was the centerpiece of starting these churches. She went to the streets of Accra at 9 years old to work, lived on the streets, homeless, from 9 to 23, went home and got married, and since then until now, she spent part of her time at home with her family, part of her time on the streets of Accra. When we went north, she said, I'm going to go home and stay at home, and we're going to start churches. My first trip to the U.S. after I started the church, she led the church, she led worship, and she preached. How can she? She's a woman. It was either her or nobody does it. We work with the people we have. She can preach till the spit's flying, and she can pray and worship African style. It's intense. She's married to a Muslim man with 2 or 3 wives. The Spirit of God is on her. Well, how does that work? I don't have it all figured out. But she's passionate that the gospel goes forth. We now have a local pastor working with us. And when I'm gone, he now leads out. Why does he lead out? Because that's the proper channel of authority. And she helps him. Before we had this man working with us, it was my wife and I, and it was her. When we left for a week or two, she ran the service and did the preaching. We now have a man. And he now preaches most of the time when I'm gone. He leads and she assists because that's the proper channel of authority. It's been an intense journey. The first service we did, I think there was 2 or 3 converts our first service. And this girl here, her name is Esther. She was our first convert in a crowd of probably 75, 80 people who are very troubled, very dysfunctional, deeply wrapped up in voodoo and witchcraft and Satanism and Islam. She was so dysfunctional, I picked her out of the whole crowd. And that's saying a lot because it was a dysfunctional crowd. And I was like, Lord, help her. She needs something I barely had faith for. She got born again that day. This was the way she looked probably 2 months into it, and she looked much better. And this next picture, she's on your left. This was taken about 6 weeks ago. That is the power and the transformation of the gospel. We now have a small group of probably 7 or 8 believers. We're doing discipleship classes. We're gearing up to do a baptism. But the gospel is going forth. This is considered an unreached tribe, which in my opinion, it's barely unreached anymore because there is other groups doing a bunch of church planting work among them. And there is a fair amount of Christians, including reproducing Christians where they're reproducing their own pastors and leaders. It's a reproducing group, which I think when they're producing their own leaders from themselves, when it comes out of the unreached status, still considered unreached, but I'm not quite sure why. It's probably about to switch. But there is a tremendous spiritual fight. This lady, the old lady on your right, she got born again, and she started talking about these demonic attacks she has at night. And we're finding out many of the women have these attacks. The demons come in, they rape them, they beat them up. It's intense. Very, very dark and very, very intense. The horrific thing these women experience at the hands of the dark side at night is horrible. So we started praying for her, and to this day, I still pray for her every Sunday. And for the demonic strongholds to break, we were praying for her. One Sunday, we had an extra prayer ceremony for her to break through this demonic bondage in her. That night, the demons came and beat her up so bad, the next day she was black and blue and could barely walk. Because we had prayed for her, and I walked away scratching my head, where's the power of the gospel that we profess to have? We're dealing with witch doctors that can heal a broken arm simply by touching it. If we're to break through, we've got to manifest a higher power. Where's the power? Where's the authority? And we started contending for the power of God to come through. So it trumps the darkness. It has to trump. Light needs to trump darkness. And it's been a journey. It's starting to crack. There was a 15, 16-year-old girl that started coming to service after service after service. We'd lay hands on her and pray for her because she requested it. She would hit the ground screaming in a deliverance, rolling around in the dirt Sunday after Sunday. And we're like, why is this thing breaking? We did it for 3 Sundays, and it broke. But we started realizing we're up against a dark principality, a dark force here who does not want to budge. But we are here to unseat this thing. We moved there, started a church. My wife and I prayed and declared that we're taking spiritual dominion over this area, over everything that's dark. And my wife promptly lost a baby at 15 weeks pregnant. How do we explain that? We don't have it figured out. In Africa, if you have a miscarriage or a stillborn, it is automatically assumed to be the works of a witch doctor. We don't know what happened. We have some ideas. We're not trying to figure it out. We gave the whole thing to God, and we buried the baby in a cemetery. It was rough. But we were up against a tremendous fight, and we still are. But we're contending for the souls of people. This woman has now broken through. After probably 4 months of praying for her, every Sunday the demons no longer come and torment and harass her at night. We broke through with her. The 15, 16-year-old girl we're working with, she also broke through. We had a few small healings, not what we hoped to see, but it's starting to crack. I can come to the U.S., I can go to southern Ghana, and I can operate with an authority and an anointing that I'm barely able to access there because of the demonic that's there. There is a difference of spiritual principalities and beings in darkness. There is a big difference. But we're contending, we're pressing in. In March, we're planning to have a big crusade in the village with a whole bunch of people. We're going to have a prayer team there for a month before we start praying and interceding for hours, for 30 days. And then roll into a crusade. And when Isaac does a crusade, we see dozens of deliverances and healings and miracles. The supernatural just flows for meeting after meeting after meeting. But we're believing the turning point is going to happen at that crusade. So in between now and the crusade happens in March, we're forming a leadership team. We're training the leadership team, and we're building this thing. So when this thing hits, and we have 30, 40 new believers, that the infrastructure is there to catch them. So we got our work cut out. It has been an intense journey. It has been very tough. That area is considered so difficult to live, so harsh, that the people in Ghana who did not grow up there said it is too hard for even them to move there. I moved there with my family. It's been a rough six or seven months that we lived there. It's been very tough. There's two seasons, hot and hotter. Extreme poverty, hunger, disease, sickness. In the dry season, animals are half starved, sewage. It's a mess. But there is souls there. And bless God, that is why we're there. There is hundreds of children in these villages. These are very remote, fairly primitive villages. Oh, they do have smartphones, believe it or not. Most of the men have two, three, four wives. The most that I heard was like 40 or 50 women. He has over 400 children. It's a bit intense. I think some of those people need an addiction program or something that's immersed in Jesus Christ or something like that. But I keep telling our team, if we get nothing but the children for the next 15 years and we teach them Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, we have something worth having. 30, 40 children often show up Sundays. And they sit there and they listen. They now have the songs memorized and they're now worshiping as well. They're children. But we're immersing them. We're hoping to start a private school with time so we can teach them reading, writing, and arithmetic and the gospel and the Bible in a Muslim voodoo village. That is what a church service looks like. We're in the dirt. We're in the manure. If we get rained out, we can't have church. But we do the best with what we have, with what we have to work with. And God is doing something. We have already gotten permission by the chief down the through the bush, down the road, to start a church there as soon as our team is able to handle it. We already have requests for two more villages to start churches, but we have decided that we're going to take it slow and not grow too fast where it goes bang, where it blows up. We're systematically putting the pieces in place with the church planting in the north. So David is still doing the street ministry in Accra. He's reaching hundreds of people. But we are also now reaching some of those same people in the north and targeting their husbands and the men who need to be reached. If you're interested in following us, here's the information: Facebook, Instagram, Crusades for Christ International. There is also a Crusades for Christ Church International. That is Isaac's main church Facebook page. It is not the Facebook page overall for the ministry. Crusades for Christ International, we have a brand new website, which is crusadesforchrist.org. If you're interested in following us, there is a lot of things happening that I was not able to cover this morning. We have a Bible school that's currently not running this year, but we'll probably start next year again. That is training church leaders and pastors. And in my opinion, from what I've seen, it's a very high impact one-year Bible school. People live on site and they get taught and trained and equipped, and all kinds of stuff happens for like 11 or 12 months. So there's a Bible school, the street ministry, the church planting stuff in the north. There's a lot of pastors' conferences, training workshops happening that Isaac is leading. There is a lot of stuff that is happening in the ministry in Crusades for Christ right now. Crusadesforchrist.org has a lot of information. There's all the different programs represented there, some of our main leadership. If you're interested in following us, our biggest need at this point is people standing with us in prayer to break through the darkness and the witchcraft in the villages in the north that we're working in. It is very, very, very dark. There's a lot of people die. There's murders that happen. Rape is normal. It's a way of life. There's a lot of very, very horrific things happen. A few weeks ago, we had a guy end up in one of our bedrooms at night looking for a girl in our house. I was in the U.S. My wife and children were at home with the hired girl who lives with us and works for us. Long story short, he fled the house when he saw my wife. He was terrified and fled, thank God. But it is a tremendous fight. Our children are complaining of experiencing demonic beings in the rooms at night, and they're 9, 7, 5. But it's intense. They're scared to go to bed, scared of the dark, because of all the stuff that we're upsetting. We're not in defense mode here. We're going deep in the offensive, and we know it. But we are inviting people to stand with us in prayer to move this thing through and to reach these churches. Currently, we have more requests to start churches in these villages due to the street outreach in Accra than we can even handle, than we can even do at this point. But we're working with the resources we have. But prayer to break the yoke of bondage there is our biggest need. If you're interested in getting involved financially, crusadesforchrist.org, you can do one-time donation. You can be a monthly partner if you so choose. Our biggest need right now is monthly partnerships, because it helps us know how many churches to start, how many workshops and seminars and conferences that we can plan, because that all requires funds. So if one-time donations are great, recurring donations are amazing if you so feel led to do that. crusadesforchrist.org. I also have some flyers outside. Luke, I'm not quite sure where he put them. Yeah, it's down the hallway there. It has information, website, information, phone number, some of that stuff on there if you want to check us out some more. But our biggest need is prayer to push through that thing. And secondary to that is specifically monthly partners if you're interested in partnering. God is doing a work, and we're moving forward. There's a lot of restructuring happening in the ministry, a lot of really good things happening. Just in this last year, there's been 3 churches started, and one of them already has 30 or 40 members. So 2 of them are started in the south with Isaac, and one of them was started in the north with us. And we have multiple requests in the north, and they have multiple locations in the south. They can start more churches. And we're growing as fast as we can train leadership to lead these churches. We're not looking at me leading the churches in the north long term because I'm white. And the reason for that is it's a very poor area. They see white, they see money. And we see for best results, we want to have local leadership, and I empower them. Where I am not the face, they're the face. Because there's this thing there that it's just the white man's religion. It's a little harder to say that if there are people who are doing a lot of the preaching. So that is the model we want to put in place. That's a photo of my family. We have 5 children born in 3 different countries. I think by the time our oldest was 6 years old, he had been in 12 countries. We've seen a lot. God has done a work. It has been intense. It has been very maturing, very humbling. But my wife and children are currently in Ghana right now. I'm only here for a week. So prayers for us as a family would also be greatly appreciated. Living in the north is very intense. It's very challenging. There's another missionary that lives in the same town we do. They have missions in over 30 countries, and he said the missions in northern Ghana and surrounding areas is their toughest mission posts that they have in over 30 countries. It's just tough. We're not sure why, except the witchcraft is so deep and so intense. If for 1,000 years, every generation makes deep commitments in with dark side, it builds strongholds. However, we hold the key to unlock it. It is the power of God. It is the power that breaks the bondage, that breaks the yoke. So we are there to let our light shine. We are there to love people. We're there to empower the locals to reach their people. Anyway, questions. Any of you have questions on Crusades for Christ, what we're doing? I'm going to have a short question and answer, so feel free to fire away. I feel them. Don't be bashful. Well, I'll be around afterwards as well. I'll probably stay for lunch. So if you want to chat, hear more, let me know. I'll be around. And grab a brochure on your way out. There's information on there. Website information is on there. If you want to check out the website, follow us on social media, which is Crusades for Christ.